Thanks for listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara Byrne. On this Wednesday night, what would a second Trump presidential term look like? It's a question on many minds these days, with the U.S. presidential election just a little more than 6 months away. Time national political reporter Eric Cortaleza sat down with Trump in person at Mar-a-Lago, then spoke with him again on the phone over the course of a month to put those questions to him and get a real sense of what he has planned. He joins me to talk about the result, a long and heavily read and scrutinized article in Time called How Far Trump Would Go. Well, it was 1 year ago today that we learned about the passing of Gordon Lightfoot at the age of 84, the legendary Canadian singer-songwriter. And a legendary Canadian singer-songwriter in his own right, Ron Sexsmith, joins me to talk about his many memories of Lightfoot, including standing outside in the cold at the stage door at Massey Hall to hear him play when he was younger, having Lightfoot show up for Sexsmith's first show at Massey Hall in 2006, and much, much more. But first, one of Canada's most wanted was arrested in PEI on Tuesday in connection with the shooting death of 29-year-old Sharmar Powell Flowers in Toronto last summer. It came shortly after the suspect was included in a BOLO, or Be on the Lookout, program. It offers up to $100,000 for tips that lead to arrests of the most wanted. We speak to the mum of the victim about finally getting that phone call from police to say that there had been an arrest, how the BOLO program helped, and her message to other families of murder victims out there waiting for justice. We begin tonight with a family that is going through a bittersweet experience today. It began with an arrest yesterday of Canada's most wanted fugitive. And again, a deep sense of relief, but also a deep sense of bittersweet relief for one Toronto family. Charlottetown police took Nathan Michael Beebe into custody in PEI on Tuesday evening. The 35-year-old is wanted in connection with the fatal shooting last summer of Sharmar Powell Flowers in Toronto's East End after an apparent altercation. Beebe's accused of second-degree murder in connection with the death of the 29-year-old. The matter has not yet been before the courts, of course. But the arrest came just a week after Beebe was listed as the most wanted fugitive on an updated list released by a group called, or the BOLO, Be on the Lookout program. This is a project run by the Stéphane Crétier Foundation charity, which helps raise awareness about the country's most wanted. The program was offering a $100,000 reward for tips. Now, Toronto police haven't said exactly how they got this information yet, so we don't know if the tip came in that way. However, Toronto police contacted their counterparts on Prince Edward Island after receiving information that the suspect may indeed be in that province, and that is exactly where he was. So he's been taken into custody. He's there in prison now, or in behind bars, at least in custody. And it's believed the Toronto police will bring him back to Ontario in the coming days. This, though, has been a really difficult time for the Flowers family. Of course, his mom, Charmaine, raised six kids on her own. Sharmar was the youngest of them. And they were very close as a family and very close as a mother and son. So she'd been waiting for this phone call for a very long time. Since last summer, she was promised by police that they would track down the people responsible for her son's death, or at least believed to be responsible, alleged to be responsible for her son's death. There was an arrest last year of one suspect, and now there is another suspect in custody. And so Charmaine Flowers agreed to speak with us, not just about finding out that news, but also to try and give some hope to others out there who've lost loved ones to crime, and about what kind of, you know, endurance, what kind of resilience you need to try to keep going while waiting for that phone call that finally came for Charmaine Flowers last night as she took a streetcar home from work. And Charmaine Flowers' mother, Sharmar Powell Flowers, joins me now from Toronto. Charmaine, first of all, our deepest condolences, of course, to you and your family. I know this can't be easy, there must be some joy, but bittersweet joy tonight.
Yes, it is mixed emotions, because I'm glad, like I said, that person, I don't want to call his name, is no longer on the streets, and we're safer. Well, wherever, I know he was caught in PEI, so I'm happy for that, but as a mom, I'm not happy, like I said, because my child is still dead, and there's nothing that's going to bring him back.
That must be the tough part too, because you're waiting to hear that news that someone has been caught. At the same time, you probably already know that it's not gonna, I mean, it'll bring you a sense of relief, but it won't heal the real wounds, right?
No, it won't. And the weirdest thing is I was been waiting for this call because I call the police all the time,
Right.
and I know that they'll call me, but I still call. And it's just so weird because I thought, oh my God, when he's arrested, I'm gonna be so happy. I'm gonna be, you know. And it's weird because when I just got the call, I was really happy and I was, you know, joyful.
Yeah.
But then when my kids came and they were all crying, and I'm like, what's happening? Why are they, you know? And I'm like, wow, it's a different, you know. So I realized throughout the day today that no, this is bittersweet. I'm not happy. I'm happy, yes, that the because I don't want to seem like I'm ungrateful. You know what I mean? Like
No.
the Bolo team put out the money. The detectives worked hard, so I do not want to take that away from them. But as a mom, let me tell you something. Losing your child is like losing my soul. I'm telling you that right now. It's like I'm a walking zombie. So I'm just walking, but I don't know how I'm surviving. I don't know. This might sound cruel, but if my son was a construction engineer and he worked on 40-story buildings, so if the cops had knocked my door and said, Cameron Shamar, God forbid, fell off the building, or he had cancer or he died from a car accident, I could have accepted it. But this, I don't know what to call him, whoever did it, because I don't know who did it. To shoot someone in their heart and to shoot someone in their head, that's personal. I don't care what nobody says.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So for him to put a hole in my son's heart, what did he think was going to happen to us?
It hits
Did
the
he
whole
stop to
family,
think?
right?
Yes, and it hits oh my God, Jamar had a lot of friends that I never even knew existed until we had that vigil.
Right.
Hundreds of people showed up. And I would say maybe 60% of the people there I never met in my life.
And it sounded like he'd lived such a full life, even at 29, and there was so much more to come.
Oh my God, he went to this kid was a daredevil. When he went to Portugal, he did the run with the Bulls.
Right.
And I thought when I saw the video, I'm like, you could have died. And when the Raptors won, he was on top of his streetcar. He lived life, he traveled. And I have a ne my grandson plays soccer and basketball, and he's there
His
for
nephew,
them.
right?
And
His nephews,
yes,
right?
his
Yeah.
nephew. And one of my sons played soccer for Canada, so he always got us the tickets to the Jamaica games.
Right.
So I always had two flags, Jamaica and Canada, and I would really, you know, kick him
Yeah.
off and he'd be like, okay, mom, like, it's a team. But it hurts because we did everything together. You'd be shocked to know that. Me and Tamara went to soccer games. We did everything together. As mother and son, it would be weird because, you know, most kids, they don't want to go anywhere with their mom. But this kid, like I said, he took care of me.
Right.
He
And you had
had the
it's he
most
was
missed me.
one of six, right? He has many siblings.
He's a baby.
He's the
He
baby,
was
of
a baby,
course.
but he was the man. Like I'm telling you, like he was so selfless. Okay, Shamar would go to work for 12 hours and he'd come home and do Uber. I cooked for him. He loves to eat. So I woke him up every morning at 4:30, and then I would make sure I made enough food so he'd have a beautiful lunch. You know,
Wow.
I always made sure that I took care of him like the best way. Like we never had money, we never had much because I was a single mom. But for me to raise six children successfully, you know, I thank God every day because it wasn't easy. It was a lot of work. But Shamar was just he was just like a guiding light, a shining star. He never hesitated to help anybody. You know, like I know people right now that he died and they still don't owe him money. Like he was the person that if you called him and said, can I borrow this, he wouldn't hesitate. You know,
Yeah.
he was always willing to help. And it just hurts me how not one person reached out to us as a family to say, okay, there's no resources, there's nothing.
Yeah,
There's
you would have found that.
absolutely nothing. 6 months of EI and go back to work. Have a nice day. So when your kid died, you're telling me in a big country like Canada, your kid dies. I wrote to Trudeau, I wrote to Doug Ford, I wrote to Olivia Troy, I wrote to everybody for somebody to say, we need resources. We deserve to have a place, a center for homicide victims. I'm
Right.
sorry.
For
This is a
stuff.
big country. We need to have a place of healing
Right.
because there's nothing. Where we had the vigil, we had his flowers and his cars, and they got rid of it. So we have
Yeah.
nothing.
Tell me a bit about getting the phone call, because I was looking back and the police were often giving updates, and it felt like the police continued to search for this suspect. And as you mentioned, you called them and you finally got that phone call from them last night. I think you told me you were on the
Yes,
streetcar.
I was on the streetcar going home, and the people were looking at me crazy because like, maybe you're going to see me on YouTube. Who knows? Because I was going crazy. I was ecstatic. I was happy. And I thanked him. And I want to tell you this. Detective Trevor Grieve, you already know about the how it is with the black race and the police. You already know. I don't have to explain that. Let me tell you something. And I'm going to say this as a proud black woman. Detective Trevor Grieve is an exemplary man. Okay?
He was the lead detective in this case, right?
Yes, respectful, dignity. There are no words, okay? And whenever I tell him this, he said, "Oh, it's the entire team." But you know what? It starts from the top, right? Because if the top person doesn't have that dignity and compassion, your workers won't, right? And he promised me the first day when she, my dad, we went to the police station because we couldn't go to the hospital. They already said he's a homicide victim, and I would not see him. And he promised me. He said, "Charmaine, you will get that first call." And let me tell you, I don't know how to explain it because when I called them and called him, he said, "Don't worry, we'll call you when we get something." And I know there was nothing for him to call me for. So I'm like, "Did you get him?" And he said, "Yes, we did." I knew it. I
You
don't
knew
know
when
how
he
to
called.
explain it to you. I knew that call. But let me tell you something else. Canadians are the most loving, generous, kindest people in the world. I can say that proudly.
Well,
It doesn't matter.
you are Canadian, Charmin. You're part of us.
What I'm just saying it like, okay, no disrespect. I am born in Jamaica, but I love Canada. This is my home. Okay? Canada gave me all my opportunities. I came here at 9 years old and I'm 60 now, so do the math, okay? We know that our people help. And I knew it was just a matter of time, money or not, that somebody was going to call because that's who Canadians are. I knew one person, money or not, would make that call. It was just a matter of time.
Charmaine Flowers is the mother of Sharmar Powell Flowers, who was the victim of a homicide in Toronto last summer at the age of 29. The suspect in the case, one of the suspects in the case, had been on. There'd been a search for him for months, for almost a year now. And after a televised or after an appeal had put him as one of Canada's most wanted, he was found. There was information to Toronto police that suggested that he was in Charlottetown, PEI, and he was arrested there last night. Toronto police apparently will be going down there to bring him back in the coming days. Charmaine, what was it like to have this case on the Bolo program, to see it sort of be featured that way, knowing that you'd have all these people on the lookout for you in some senses?
I was ecstatic. First of all, I didn't even know how to put it into words because the fact that he was even number one, I broke down. I got that call at work as well. And when I researched it and I saw how effective it was, and the fact that the police realized that we have to use media, these are the times of the media. People go on social media now. People are not really going into newspapers anymore. So when I really realized that he was placed in that program, I thought, okay, this is it. I don't know how to explain it to you, but I know the Bola program was going to be successful. And I spoke to Alex today, who is the person that's in charge of the Bola program. And I told him, God bless him. He's a remarkable man because a lot of people out there have access to money, but they don't really care about, putting their money into resources like this. And I told him to tell his parents for me tonight how they raised a wonderful human being. But I want to let these people know that please don't give up hope.
Yeah, I
Toronto
was going to say
police,
there are others out there
Toronto
who
police. Yes,
there
I
are
want to
other
let them
many
know
others.
I'm grieving. I'm grieving with them. I want to let them know that that's why it's also bittersweet because I'm thinking about all these other people out there who are still waiting for that call. But please believe me, I am here with you. I am now a part of that Bola family. It works. They just have to have hope. Please have faith. Have hope. It's going to come. It will come.
And you must have a message not just to the person who may have called in a tip on this in your case, but also to others out there who have information in other cases, because sometimes I guess it's indescribable what kind of change just one piece of information can make in the lives of someone in your situation and others in the same in your shoes.
Please, it's very important. Just open up your heart. Just call tip line. There's people suffering out there. There are people that need your help. Please just pick up the phone. It will make a difference to someone. Believe you me, because it made a difference to me. Just please pick up that phone and give someone that trust that they deserve. Please, thank you.
Well, Charmaine, our condolences, of course, to you. I know how difficult, even with the good news, how heart-wrenching this is for you still. And I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about Sharmar and talk about yourself and talk about the arrest. And all the best from us too, right? From all of us listening to you and your family.
Thank you so much. Have yourself a good night. Take care.
Asked me to record a Lightfoot song for this 50th anniversary project. I knew that I wanted to do something off one of his later records, mostly because it's always bothered me that some people see him as something that happened before, like 1976. And I was a fan of all those later records. My favorite one, in fact, is called Waiting For You, which happened in the 90s. You know, but this song, Stay Loose, that we decided to do, came from an album called East of Midnight, which I've heard was Gordon's favorite. It's an album that I've always been quite fond of too, although we felt that it suffered a little bit from 80s production, so we wanted to address that in our version, which I think we did. But it's a great song. I love the melody. I love the sentiment. I love how there's a guitar figure that quotes the melodic motif from If You Could Read My Mind. I always found that interesting. But anyway, I hope we did a good job. I could have picked any number of songs. I love all of his music.
Ron Sexsmith there describing really the thought processes behind why he decided to cover a Gordon Lightfoot song from the 80s called Stay Loose for a 50th anniversary tribute. You know, long before Sexsmith found international success in the mid-90s with songs such as Sacred Heart, the St. Catharines born singer-songwriter had been a big Gordon Lightfoot fan, as you can tell just from listening to him there. He even stood outside the stage door at Toronto's famed Massey Hall to hear the legend until he was able to afford to buy tickets to actually go inside and see that annual show that Gordon Lightfoot put on at Massey Hall. And Lightfoot returned the favor in 2006 by quite famously showing up to see Sexsmith's first Massey Hall concert back then. Ron was actually on tour in Ireland last May the 1st, a year ago today, when we all got word that Gordon Lightfoot had passed away at the age of 84. And immediately he dedicated the rest of that tour through Ireland, the UK, and Europe to one of his musical idols. A year later, Sexsmith continues to cover his songs in concert. He's even been posting versions of covers that he's done over the years, old and new, on social media as a tribute to Lightfoot. He's also about to head out on a brief five-stop Canadian tour with famed British rock star Nick Lowe in June. But I wanted to talk to him tonight about Gordon Lightfoot, how he inspired a young singer-songwriter to try to find his voice more than 30 years ago now, and how Lightfoot's legacy seems to have only grown over the years since his death. And Ron Sexsmith joins me now. Ron, thank you so much for your time tonight.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
Interesting that you were, funny that I always associate you and Gordon Lightfoot so much with being in Canada, and you happened to be away last year when he passed. I remember you posted some really touching stuff on social media from Ireland, but you played Gordon Lightfoot songs throughout that tour after that.
Yeah, I mean, I did, you know, even before he passed, I would do that on occasion. I mean, but yeah, especially when we heard the news every night, I dedicated the rest of the tour to him, you know, and I mean, I knew he wasn't doing well, you know, before I left, and I was sort of afraid that might happen, but you know, I'm just really glad I got to see him so many times at Massey Hall. It was really my favorite thing to do.
You used to even go before you had tickets, right? That's a great story that you tell about sort of standing out in the cold at the stage door, sort of leaning in.
Yeah, no, I did that quite a few times, not just for Gord, but for other concerts. And I'd sit, stand by the stage door. Now you can't do it anymore because it's all renovated and you wouldn't be able to do that. But and then, you know, oftentimes I'd wait for someone to come out so I could get their autograph or whatever, you know. I was just such a music freak, you know. I still am, I guess.
A true blue fan. I mean, I was listening to you talk about where that all began with sort of, as the love of music so often begins for musicians and non-musicians alike, including myself, it kind of comes with a record collection, something you dive into young and discover.
Yeah. Yeah. And on Twitter, I'm always posting which records I'm listening to. Yeah. I mean, and I'll, you know, obviously I'm old, and so most of the music I listen to is old, you know, and, but that's sort of my happy place. You know, I love the format, you know, vinyl. I still listen to CDs as well, but yeah. And I have a really nice record listening room. You know, it's kind of got this gnarly carpeting. You know, just it just sounds really good in there. And so, yeah, I'm keeping the faith for sure.
Yeah, I was just back home. I sold a house recently. I had to sort of move all my vinyl out into somewhere else, and went was digging through it over the weekend and brought back a lot of memories. I love the vinyl, just no room where I live now for it. Interesting the way some of what you've said about Gordon Lightfoot. I think even last year, so many of us sort of replayed all the songs you would have thought of, you know, his big hits from the late 60s into the mid 70s, and very little from later in his career. And you've sort of always been a fan of stuff that he did that may have gone a little bit unnoticed by the casual fan.
Yeah, that's how big of a fan I am. I mean,
Right.
my favorite is actually called Waiting for You, which came out in the 90s, and it never got a vinyl release. I'm hoping that all might happen. And I know that he told me a few times that his favorite was East of Midnight from the 80s.
Right.
And so sometimes the later albums, the production wasn't super great, or maybe it was dated or something, but the songs are killer on all those records. And even the most recent one, Solo, that he put out in 2020, I love that record. It's just him and the guitar, and most of it was recorded before he, you know, when he had when he fell ill a few 10 years ago, whatever. He had like a ulcer or something, so he's still singing quite good on it. But yeah, and I love all the old records too. But it's just I'm always interested what my favorite artists are up to later in their career, you know.
Yeah, I think you did a cover of Stay Loose, which is on East of Midnight as well, right?
You know, on my YouTube channel, I've done so many Lightfoot songs, like from all periods of his career. But I do like the later ones, you know, from Shadows onward. They're just yeah, and I think they have been sort of overlooked, which is only natural, right? If the McCartney puts out a new album, people go to the concert. They mostly just want to hear the hits. They don't want to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It happens to everyone, I think, you know.
Yeah. And the 80s was kind of, if I think back, because I was actually listening to that East of Midnight album a little bit earlier today, it was very much of its time and it sounds dated. I wonder if it always will. There must be a whole generation of kids out there who listen to that stuff like we used to listen to, like the Stones in the 70s, right? To think, wow, this is awesome to listen to those synthesizers and that drum machine, you know? But it's kind of, you're right, it kind of gets lost a bit in the production, at least to the modern ear.
Yeah, and I'm sure there were probably people who that was their entry point to Gordon Lightfoot, that album as well, you know, if that's what they like. You know, the 80s was a difficult period for me. I couldn't get signed, and I didn't have the sound. And I think a lot of artists of Gord's generation were trying to adapt to fit in with the 80s. Like Crosby, Stills and Nash they all tried, you know. And so you just have to get over that. And I'm pretty good at bypassing the production. And you know, getting to the heart of the matter, like even Waiting for You, which is my favorite Gord album, if that album had been done in the 70s, it would have had real strings on it, not synth pads, you know. And I just think it was Gord trying to keep up with the times in a way. I just his point of view is what I go there for, to get his melody and his point of view. And I think he was in a kind of a good place when he made those albums, because you know, he calls it his good, bad, and ugly period, where he was, you know, drinking a lot and this and that. And so whenever I got a chance to meet him, he was always very friendly. And you know, where I maybe at another time had I met him, he wouldn't have been so friendly or something.
Yeah.
But I just feel those albums all have a real upbeat nature to them, you know, lyrically, and he seems like he was in a good place. So
Yeah. He was, I mean, you've met him obviously, after sort of standing at the stage door listening to him when you were younger. He actually
yeah.
came to see you at Massey Hall as well. There was a really nice circle. Now I'm going to use the cheesiest of terms, but a nice kind of circle of life there between you and Gordon Lightfoot.
Yeah, that was one of the biggest honors of my life when he came to see me. Because it's funny, on the day of that show, it was already an exciting day because I was playing Massey Hall for the first time. But he called me in the morning. I was in bed actually, and I don't know how he got my number even. But you know, I had done a song called Drifters on a tribute album, and he just automatically assumed that I was going to play it that night, which I hadn't planned on it. And he said, "Well, when you play Drifters tonight, make sure you pick up the tempo." And I was like, okay, you know, because I'm not going to say no to Gord. So I had to kind of relearn it. And then I did it in the set. But yeah, and then he came back afterward. It was just still surreal for me.
I guess when Gord makes a request, you play the request, right?
Well, Gord is just, you know, one letter away from God, right? So yeah, you kind of have to, you know, when he says jump, say how high, basically.
Ron Sexsmith is with us this half hour. We're talking about the passing of Gordon Lightfoot. Ron Sexsmith was both colleague and big fan of Gordon's for many, many, many years. Ron, I mean, I guess there's been a lot of, the last year has been interesting because I think when I was growing up, and you came to Gordon Lightfoot, I think, a bit later in your love of music. I came to Gordon Lightfoot a bit later. You know, I wasn't going to listen to, you don't listen to Gordon Lightfoot when you're 12, I don't think, or 14 or 17. Yeah. But it's interesting. What have you made of the last year of sort of this reverence for him that has emerged, this real appreciation of what he had done? Because I felt like over time that had been lost, maybe perhaps not if you ask people directly about it, but we didn't talk about it as much as perhaps we should have.
Yeah, and I think that's only natural in a way. You know, people, like I went to see him every year and he was always full. Like it wasn't like he wasn't packing them in anymore. He still was. But obviously, and this is true of my music too. It wasn't resonating with the culture, you know, in the way, in the current, it wasn't Shawn Mendes or something like that, you know. Right. And that's, you can't expect to, I mean, he had a good run of hits for a long time. I mean, I never had hits like that, but I mean, there was a certain point where I felt that I was, you know, in the business in a way, you know, I was going to the Junos and it's been like 10 years since the last time I was nominated or for anything. So mm-hmm. I think that just happens, you know, if you hang around long enough, you just hope that you can establish yourself. But he obviously was so well established. And I mean, in Toronto every year, they used to have a Gordon Lightfoot tribute concert at Hughes Room and he would go every year, you know.
People, his own tribute, right? Yeah.
Yeah, just at Hughes Room, just this tiny place. And people were super charged that he was in the room. But anyway, I just think it happens with people, you know, so they don't really miss you till you're gone or something, you know. So.
Yeah, it's must have been interesting to watch him too, because as you just played your Sexsmith at 60 concert on Leap Day, actually on the 29th at Massey Hall, speaking of Massey Hall, but it must be interesting to have watched him evolve through the years as a songwriter and also then follow in his footsteps to some extent. I mean, in the sense that you kind of see how your views of things change, how your music changes, you know, how you, what you like, what you don't like, etc.
Yeah, and I look back on it all for me, and it's just every album has been such a struggle just to write it, to get it out. So I can't believe I've made so, you know, many of them, and Gordon too. I mean, that's pretty much all he did from 65 till, you know, he just toured or he wrote, made records. And the thing I got from him is I always love to look on the back cover and it said all songs written by Gordon Lightfoot, because all my albums say that, you know.
Right.
I think the only time he did co-write was with David Foster on Anything for Love, you know, but he had such a great sort of work ethic. You could really tell just each individual song how much work he put into the structure of it and the lyrics, the internal rhyming schemes and all that kind of stuff. I was paying close attention, you know. I don't know if I answer your question, but
yeah, you know,
but over the years, it was interesting to see him play live because, you know, I saw different, you know, when I started seeing him, he was still kind of coming out, you know, like wearing a Hawaiian shirt or something like that, you know. And then towards the end, he had this really long hair pushed back with this really classy kind of smoking jacket or whatever it was on. And it was always exciting to hear. I mean, obviously there were seven or so songs that he kind of had to play every night, but then the rest of his set would be up for grabs. And he always played, you know, deep cuts or whatever, and recent things. So I don't know. My favorite Canadian thing to do was to go see him at Massey Hall.
Yeah. And just thinking back about some of those songs that he wrote, to think about the Wreck of the Edmunds Fitzgerald today, I mean, it's hard to imagine. In fact, at the time, it was hard to imagine it would be a hit. But that was something about his storytelling gift, too, which is something that you've done mm-hmm. as well. I mean, that is the beauty of writing and producing your own and writing your own stuff and singing your own stuff, is you can mm-hmm. kind of tell stories if you want to.
I think he was lucky, and a lot of those songwriters were lucky in a way, too, to come up at a time when radio would play that kind of stuff.
Right.
They wouldn't anymore, you know. Yeah. And also at a time, I think, when people had a much longer attention span. So I just think they were really fortunate, like not just Gord, but Joni and all these people to have hits that are, you know, now they'd be saying, well, that can't be a hit because where's the chorus? Or they want you to get to the chorus within the first verse, you know what I mean, the first bar or something.
Yeah.
It's very, very repetitive and, you know, and I've never had much luck with radio. I mean, I had a couple things in the UK that got on the charts, you know, but he had a lot of, I think Edmund Fitzgerald might have even been a chart topper. Did that go to number one?
Yeah, Sunrise, I think, went to number one. There's been a few, but all of them, like he had a string of big Billboard hits, which was for the song, for the style of music. I suppose the early 70s was pretty friendly to that kind of.
Well, for songwriters, all of them, they all did well. Jim Croce, James Taylor, you know.
Even Harry Chapin, right? I mean, it's all kind of, it was very much a genre at the time that he was excellent at. You're out on tour. You're coming out our way. You're going to be out in BC and then doing the Prairies and back east as well. That must always be, I mean, you did a lot of concerts last year, but it must be nice to play in Canada.
Yeah, because I feel like I don't get to do it as much as some people. And I mean, I have a bigger audience overseas and Canada. I mean, I do okay here, but Canada could be a bit of a struggle. Obviously, the traveling is hard too. I mean, there's no cities, major cities that are that close to each other. But, you know, Nick Lowe, who I'm going to be touring with, is a really good friend of mine. And we did some tours together in the mid 2000s. But not here. We toured America and we toured over in the UK. And so when I played London last year, he came to the show and we were hanging out backstage. And I just said, I hope we can do that again. That was so much fun. Like, you know, maybe we should do it, you know, try Canada. But I never thought he was going to follow up on it. But then it was just a few months later, his manager reached out to my manager. And my only regret is I wish there were more shows. There's just a five, but yeah, we're coming to Vancouver on what is it, the
I think 10th? June 10th. I love Nick Lowe, and obviously there's the Elvis Costello connection. He's married to Diana Krall. I mean, there's a lot of Canadian stuff going on, but the Nick Lowe connection is great because I mean, he too has been one of those artists over the years who's maybe, I don't want to say he's flown under the radar. I think I still have the 45 of Cruel to Be Kind at home, but what an amazing artist and what an appreciation there is for you as well, but for him still in his in the UK.
I love all his later albums too, just like Gord, you know, like Impossible Bird and Dig My Mood and The Confessor and all that stuff. He's a very funny guy, but he was the first guy I ever heard do cover one of my songs.
Right.
Even before I met him, I was in my hotel room in London and I was listening to the BBC because they were going to interview Nick Lowe. I was all excited about it. And then at the end of the interview, he broke into Secret Heart, you know, almost fell off the bed. Yeah, he's a real class act. And so I'm looking forward to spending some time, you know, together.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting tour. Ron, thanks so much for your time tonight. I appreciate it.
No, thanks for having me. And there's no trouble at all.
It's Academic to drop it at center. Ice horn sounds and the Colorado Avalanche have defeated the Winnipeg Jets by a score of 6-3 tonight. And they've won this series by winning four straight after dropping game one. And they do so in five games.
Yeah, that was how the Winnipeg Jets season ended last night. After even the beginning of the playoffs, which showed a fair amount of hope, obviously there was always hope, but even some expectations that maybe this team that had had a really fantastic defensive record during the year and had played really well against their first round opponents, the Colorado Avalanche, that they might actually go someplace this year. But as you heard there, it was not to be. Even the whiteout in the home crowd could spur them to a must win in game five last night. They fell 6-3 to lose in five in their best of seven opening round series. That despite winning the first game at home, as was mentioned. Now, the Jets again dominated the Avalanche during the regular season, but couldn't find a way really to match them in the playoffs, although it was closer than it looks. I mean, I watched a few of the games when work didn't get in the way, and it wasn't as quite as dominant a performance by the Avalanche as it would seem by looking at the score sheet. But still, you know, they were the best defensive team in the NHL during the regular season, and they became the first team ever to give up five goals in their first five games of the playoffs in that series. So I guess there'll be lots of questions to ask, but who better to ask them than the voices you were just hearing? Paul Edmonds is the play-by-play voice of the Jets on 680 CJOB in Winnipeg, and Mitchell Clinton is the color analyst on those games as well. Thank you both for joining me tonight.
Yeah, my pleasure. Yeah, thanks for having us.
Not a problem.
Yeah, I have to say, I was... You know, I love the Jets in a way because I think a lot of Canadian fans really cheer the Jets on because wouldn't it be nice to see Winnipeg go far in the playoffs? But what a very strange series that was, Paul.
Yeah, I think that nobody expected that anybody was going to run away with the series going in. And as it turned out, I think it was maybe a game shorter than maybe people thought that it should have been. But there was a lot of, I think, aspirations of this team in Winnipeg winning this series after game one, because they did so by scoring 7 goals. And they defended fairly well in that game until near the end and gave up a couple power play goals. And it was sort of, you know, the quintessential foot coming off the gas pedal. And then you get to a situation the next game where it's 2-1 and you hit a post and it's almost 3-1. And instead of making it 3-1 because you've hit the iron, they come back down and score. And then I just kind of felt that the goaltending issues that were kind of prevalent near the end of the season for Colorado and into game one corrected themselves. Their power play got rolling. And their upper echelon players found another level. And from that standpoint, Winnipeg didn't have much of an answer. And Colorado, with that pedigree of a Stanley Cup championship only a couple of years ago, dug down and kind of used that experience to say, hey, we've got to find another gear. And they did, and away they went.
Mitchell, looking at the crowd yesterday, I think people were, I mean, a reminder in game one in that incredible 7-6 win of just what a energetic place that rink can be and the whiteout and so on. What was it like looking out over that crowd last night? Because I'm wondering what the mood was today.
Yeah, I mean, obviously tough by the end of it, but I mean, Winnipeg got pretty much the most ideal start to have in that building. And really, you think about the games themselves, like Colorado opens the scoring in game one, but that first period was 3-3 by the end, so the crowd was on their feet for a good amount of time. And then Winnipeg in game two opens the scoring a few minutes in, so you get the ideal start there. And, you know, even in game five, same situation. Winnipeg gets the first goal, and you figure away you go. But, yeah, I mean, the crowd was tremendous. A lot of my favorite memories, I've been in and around the team since at least in a working capacity since 2013, and a lot of my favorite memories are from the whiteout and just how crazy it can be in there. I know I saw one post on social media that of the Canadian crowds, because they kind of took a decibel reading off of a little machine that they have, it was Winnipeg that came out on top in that one. And it's, you know, I had to take a couple of moments, you know, during, you know, coming out of commercial breaks and whatnot, just to pop one part of my headset off my ear to really get a full experience of what it was like, you know, without the muffled headset on. So it's a special place when that crowd gets going. And I know the players really wanted to, you know, make sure that they got on their feet. They got to see a win, which was nice in game one. But, you know, kind of like what Paul said, Colorado just seemed to find a way, whether it was the games were in Winnipeg or whether they were in Colorado, they just seemed to find a way to get that next goal that Winnipeg couldn't get, despite the great push that they got from their fans.
Yeah, and Paul, what was the mood like today? I mean, I grew up in Montreal, so for when I was really young, they never lost, and then they won sporadically, and it's been a really long time since anyone's won a thing in Montreal. But what was the mood like in Winnipeg today? Was it sort of, oh no, not again, or was it, you know, just sort of this is how it went? And because if you look at, I was looking at the score sheet from each game, even last night's was much closer than 6-3 suggests. I mean, they came back, tied the game in the third, a couple of bounces either way, and this could be a 3-2 series easily.
Yeah, well, I mean, they tied the score up at 3 and at one point in the third period, and then gave up 2 goals and then an empty netter. And the mood was interesting around here, and I think that for the most part that there was a lot of optimism that went into game 5 last night. But people knew deep down that it was going to be a daunting task to try to win 3 in a row against the Colorado Avalanche to come back and win the series, even though you had the 7th game back in Winnipeg if it got that far. You know, being a father, I was out today right away with kids running them around today. There was no rest for the wicked, right, Ben. So, you know, I was at the co-op gas station and I was in a few other places. And it was interesting because the topic of conversation was, did you watch the Jets game last night? And this is amongst complete strangers. And so because Mitchell and I are in radio, people don't really know who we are. So, of course, I'm answering, you know, I've got a ball cap on my head and, you know, a jacket from my son's hockey team. So nobody knows who I am. I'm like, yeah, I watched the game last night. And then they went, well, what'd you think? So you're answering these questions. But I think what you get is the fact that
you know, the province, not just the city, but the province is engaged in what this team does. And that's the passion that you see with this hockey team. And that's why it's invaluable to this community. And when I say the community, not just Winnipeg, not just the capital region, but the entire province of Manitoba, it's important to people here. And that's why when they do well, the psyche of the community feels much better. So was it a dour mood today? Not really, because I think it would be a lot more dour if they lost in game 7 in overtime. Those are crushing, right? But I think that what happened throughout the series facilitated the fact that it wasn't a jumping off the cliff moment for the community here in Winnipeg in the province of Manitoba.
Right. Mitchell, you must have the same thing. Two people must think he really knows his Jets. Wow. Because we have the same issue. I mean, I'm on the radio, right? You can sort of say, oh, yeah, I know all about that person because you interviewed them the week before, right? But what happens now? What happens now, do you think, to this team? Because, I mean, obviously, there are some big contracts over the summer and there's a lot of expectations. Hellebuck, of course, is kind of the cornerstone of the team in many ways, and he didn't have a very good playoffs. What next? What do you think the offseason brings?
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting offseason for sure. I mean, getting Scheifele and Hellebuck kind of locked up prior to the start of the season was a big thing to do for Kevin Cheveldayoff, just because, you know, if he hadn't done that, outside of the fact that the storylines would have been, you know, following the team throughout the year, well, now you'd be getting right into that, assuming you didn't have to do anything at the trade deadline, right? So those are two big things that he's got off his to-do list, if you will. Contract-wise, you look on the back end, you got some decisions to make with Brendan Dillon and Dylan DeMello, two big parts of Winnipeg's blue line. Colin Miller, who you brought in, also an unrestricted free agent. Logan Stanley, a homegrown and developed draft pick, if you will, from 2016, is a restricted free agent. Cole Perfetti is a restricted free agent. There's a number of things that Kevin Cheveldayoff's going to have to, and his management team are going to have to work toward in the offseason. But I think, you know, obviously first things first, they'll have their year-end meetings coming up in the next couple of days here, and they'll try to get a feel for what, you know, the players think and whatnot, because, you know, just seeing and listening to a lot of the things that the players said after the game and whatnot, like, yeah, like this loss stings, but it certainly feels a lot different than how things felt, you know, after losing to the Vegas Golden Knights in 5 games afterwards as well last year. So It's going to be interesting, because I know coming out of those year-end meetings, Kevin Cheveldayoff last year, you know, felt that there was a certain level of, of pain that came with that. But this one, I think, will be different because of the regular season that they had. They didn't kind of back their way into the playoffs. They were one of those contending teams. But they also, I think, learned a lot going up against Colorado and what level your game has to get to. Just because of where Colorado has been. And even Colorado's coach before game 5 talked about some of the quote-unquote scar tissue that Colorado has developed because they've had a couple similar eliminations prior to winning the Stanley Cup in 2022. So, yeah, there's going to be a lot of things that'll have to get done over the course of the summer. And, you know, we'll be obviously, you know, right alongside covering that throughout it as it happens. But a lot of big decisions coming up for the Winnipeg Jets.
Well, Paul and Mitchell, I really wish you guys had been covering games this season much longer than you did, but we'll be cheering next year. And of course, I think CFL preseason starts in 19 days, so other sports to look forward to, I suppose, in the meantime. Thanks so much, both of you, for your time tonight.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, my pleasure. Anytime.
This is a big deal. The first seniors to register with the new federal dental care plan can now start submitting claims. Citizen Services Minister Terry Beach says more than 1.8 million Canadians have enrolled in the program.
Today, 1 million of those Canadians have received their benefit card and are eligible to access oral health services.
It is a big deal. The government started enrolling seniors late last year, and kids under the age of 18 and people who receive the disability tax credit will be eligible to enroll next month. Those aged 65 to 69, by the way, can also now apply for the program online. Health Canada says about 6,500 oral health providers have signed up to take care or to provide care to patients enrolled in the plan. Once it's fully rolled out, the program should be available to anyone without private insurance, with a family income under $90,000. So this is a huge, in fact, I think it's the biggest health program ever because of just the sheer numbers. Many patients, though, may have to wait a while to get their dental visits covered. Here's the health minister, Mark Holland.
This is the largest federal program in Canadian history, and I don't want to lead anybody astray. It's going to be a challenge to meet the entire demands of the population, and we always knew that. The goal here is not perfection, it's progress, and to move forward every day with more and more people being seen. Hundreds of thousands, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of seniors are going to be seen in May, and my objective is to make sure that we do get everybody seen and that we scale up the existing system to be able to metabolize the one quarter of Canadians who have no oral health care.
Right. Mark Holland there, the health minister, the federal health minister. Okay, so not perfection, but progress. Is that enough? Are we seeing enough progress? Joining me now is Dr. Joel Antel. He's president of the Canadian Dental Association. He's also a practicing dentist in Winnipeg. Dr. Antel, thank you for your time tonight.
Well, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
I guess just from the association's point of view, today is a big day. So far, what have you seen? What are you hearing?
Mostly what we're seeing today is what we've seen in the run-up to today. We've seen patients that have gotten a lot of information, some of it correct, some of it not, but they're anxious to get treated under this plan, and dentists that are waiting to get all the information they need, see it all finalized so they can make a decision to take part in this plan.
Right. Right now, I mean, how much is that gap? Because I understand there's been some reluctance on the part of dentists simply because they don't know enough.
There's a lot of numbers out there, and I really don't have verification. I might have heard everything from 5,000 nationally to some areas of the country where there's only four. I'm sure the right number is somewhere in between there, but I don't think that's enough healthcare professionals to be servicing the people that are going to be signing up for care under this plan, which is the ultimate goal of everybody, government and dentists, is to get the public taken care of.
Right. I mean, the demand, obviously, for anyone who hasn't been able to afford oral care for a while, the demand, we can already see there's been a lot of demand for it. Just as a reminder to listeners about how this works, from the dentist's point of view, how does this unfold when I want to go see the dentist but have it and want to sort of take part of this program?
So right now, the plan would entitle a patient to have part of the fee of some procedures that they may or may not need covered by the government plan. So the process still needs to be exactly what it would be under conventional insurance, where people are covering their dental costs and their own private resources, which is the starting point, is an examination, developing a treatment plan that's individualized to that patient, and then working out the treatment that's going to get them orally healthy and keep them that way for a lifetime. So what the plan will do is act as a subsidy towards helping afford that. The problem we're running into, of course, is that the word on the street is that it's whatever you need, it'll be done, and it's free.
Right.
That's where the conflict comes in.
And that's not the case. Just to clarify, because this is sort of part of what's been going on in terms of negotiations between the associations, including yours, and the federal government, is just exactly what that's going to look like and how it's paid for.
So I would want to correct the perception that there's a negotiation going on, because it has been portrayed as that. And from the Dental Association's standpoint, we see ourselves as working with government to make this the best possible plan.
Right.
We've identified what is necessary to make this a good workable plan for government, a plan that takes care of the public and is sustainable in dental offices. We've identified that from the very beginning. The details of that are still what we're working with government to see how we can meet their needs and our needs to move forward.
Right. I suppose it is the government, in fact, that's been describing this as a negotiation, right?
That's been one of the characterizations.
Right. Just you, I mean, you're a dentist and you haven't signed up just yet either. I mean, and I suspect that some of your hesitation is probably what we're seeing elsewhere as well. I mean, what exactly will need to be done, do you think, to bring enough comfort to dentists and others out there to sign up for this?
There's two parts. One is that the closer they can make this to conventional insurance so that it fits with how offices are currently run, the more likely we are to take part, because the less intrusiveness there is in the smooth running of our practices. The other is making sure that the government and the dentists and the media and everybody is giving information that is true and accurate so that patients come into the office knowing what to expect. One of our big administrative burdens right now is people coming in thinking that this is a free plan, and we're the ones that have to deliver the bad news. We've got to deliver the correct information And besides that being a difficult thing to do, it ties up staff and it takes people away from providing clinical care to have them providing information, which is important to do, but it reduces the amount of care we can do in an industry that, like every industry in the country right now, you're short of staff and can't find staff. So it has that kind of an impact where people that should be treating patients are busy discussing things that people should be knowing from other sources.
Right. So in other words, you've been left on the front lines to explain this, to explain how it works and doesn't work to individual people seeking dental care, which of course would be an unintended consequence that could have been perhaps easy to predict, since you are in fact the people that would be called if patients were looking for care, right?
I think it's possible for this to be handled in a way where we can have the discussions of the care and the finance like we do with all of our patients in a way that fits with the way offices are currently run, so that it can be efficient and effective.
Right. For the time being, the health minister has said they don't necessarily want to see perfection. They want to see progress. Do you feel confident in the way that it's been rolled out so far? And I know you've been consulted, all the associations have been consulted by government. Do you feel confident that that is in fact what's happening here? That, okay, it's not perfect, not nearly, not yet, but we are moving in the right direction?
The minister said something at one of our meetings that really resonated with me, because I agree with him wholeheartedly on this. And that's that you can't let perfect be the enemy of good.
Right.
We're not at good yet.
Right.
And it's important for the public to get this right, so it's not just some care, but it's the appropriate care and it's sustainable, so it's ongoing care.
Right. Not to make you answer a question that you've already said you shouldn't necessarily be answering, the government should, but just in the interim, because you will get these questions, what do you tell then my listeners, patients, prospective patients out there, what should they be doing then if not calling you, thinking they're about to get sort of A to Z free dental care?
I think they have to still go and get the care.
Right.
There are other government programs, there's provincial programs. It's not an efficient or a way I totally think is the best way to do it, but there are dental offices that are providing care for people who can't afford it, but it leaves those people that need it going office to office, really in a very uncomfortable way, walking in and saying, I can't afford it, can you take care of me?
Right.
There are many dentists that can proudly say that no one's ever left their office in pain for financial reasons, but that's not every dentist, and that's not a good system to have people have to go look for that.
No.
But that's the system we've had up until now. And I think people just, unfortunately have to endure a little bit longer while we work with government to get this right.
Right. Do you have a sense of, the numbers, today was the day that a certain proportion of people would be able to seek care for the first time. The government's sort of looking at relatively ambitious expansion of this plan. Do you feel like we need to slow down the expectations a bit?
I would rather see us work with government to get this plan right and get it rolled out to as many people as we can, as quickly as we can, because there's a definite need. And the sooner that need is met, the better.
Right.
There's some obstacles in the way. It's the government's plan. Ultimately, it's theirs to get rid of those obstacles. But we're not prepared to take a stance at saying we're not part of this. Our stance is we want to keep working with you, so that we can make this the best possible plan so dentists will wholeheartedly embrace it and people can get the care that they need.
Right. So don't let perfect be the enemy of good, but we need to get to good pretty fast. Dr. Antal, thank you.
Thanks very much. I appreciate the time to talk.
Canada's energy sector, as well as the country's main oil-producing province, celebrated Wednesday as the long-awaited $34 billion Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion officially came online. Here is Alberta Premier Daniel Smith.
Because we now have another customer to sell to, we're going to see higher prices for all of our Western Canada Select product. In the past, there's been a heavy discount. I've been told by my department officials it's probably a couple of billion dollars additional revenues.
Right. So there you have it. It is Canada's West Pipeline. Canada's West Coast has not seen a new one in more than 70 years, but it comes 11 years after the initial application to the National Energy Board, more than 6 years behind schedule, and with some really major cost overruns, rising from an estimate of roughly $5 billion in 2013 to $34 billion today. So was it worth that very high price? Trevor Tome. Our Tome is a professor of economics at the University of Calgary and a research fellow at the School of Public Policy, and he joins me now. Trevor, you've looked into this. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
Well, better late than never, right? But what an ordeal. It feels almost surreal that it's actually open for business. But tell me a bit about the cost overruns and the delays, because they've been substantial. We've talked about them a lot.
Sure. No doubt the delays and the cost overruns have been substantial, as you say. It's starting shipping oil right now, and that's 11 years, almost exactly 11 years after the initial application to the National Energy Board. And you know, just a sense of how much has changed. We don't even have a National Energy Board anymore. It's transitioned to the Canada Energy Regulator. So here we are, 2024. That's about 6 years later than the original schedule envisioned. And the cost overruns have been staggering. The initial estimate for construction back in 2013 was $5 billion. And now it looks like all in costs are $34 billion. So a dramatic increase in the cost to build this pipeline. And a lot has happened, of course, over the past few years to contribute to those cost overruns. There were lots of policy-related decisions. I know in British Columbia, if you recall, Premier Clark's five conditions, all right. Sorts of those initial barriers that Kinder Morgan was facing, adding costs because it was adding time, and then Kinder Morgan pulling out, consultation processes not being what they should have been under both Harper and again under Trudeau. So had further delays there at the federal level, Site C and Coastal GasLink competing for talent and materials at the same time. And then COVID on top of all of this, just one thing after another did ratchet up costs. And so I don't want to say that we know fully what are all the factors behind those overruns. And certainly there's going to be a very hard look at this. I suspect potentially more than one Auditor General report at some point will be pouring through to learn some lessons from this. But despite all of those increases, despite the staggering cost, the pipeline remains incredibly valuable, both individually as a pipeline, just as an asset, but also it's a key piece of infrastructure for Canada's economy.
Yeah. And it was a reminder of just how difficult it is to get things built, period. I mean, I think I hear people, you know, pulling their hair out all the time saying Canada can't build anything anymore. Well, here you have an example of why. You know, sometimes there are challenges, but ultimately they got this to the finish line. And I think there was a time, maybe 6-7 years ago, maybe more recent than that, where that wasn't necessarily looking like it was going to be a done deal.
Yeah, that's certainly true. You'd have many that didn't think the pipeline was going to be completed. I've always been of the view that it would be completed just because of how critical it is, not just for Alberta, but for economic activity right across the country, that it was going to get built one way or another. And you know, it certainly wasn't an easy road. But this process also, hopefully, and maybe I'm being too optimistic, will help us learn lessons around what to do better and what not to do that will facilitate easier major projects in the future. In particular, think about Indigenous consultations.
Right.
We didn't do that right with Trans Mountain, and then we didn't do it right again. And so we're iterating our way towards something that might allow us to do it right at the start, which would speed up future major projects and fulfill the necessary and important requirement that the real consultations occur.
Yeah, there were a lot of different changes. As you mentioned, there were many things going on over the course of 11 years. Many things happen in the background that have nothing to do with the pipeline itself. A reminder then to listeners just what a very big deal this is. I mean, not only is it the first new pipeline in decades, but it is a huge deal for Canada's ability to move its own natural resources to port.
So it's the first new pipeline to the West Coast in 70 years.
Wow.
So it has been a long time since we've expanded our export capacity in that direction. Almost everything else goes to the United States. And this is important because shipping oil by pipeline is much cheaper than the alternatives, which is rail, or in some cases, even truck. And so Trans Mountain is going to be the most expensive pipeline at $11 per barrel, which is double what the initial estimate is. And part of that is because of the cost overrun. Some of that is shifted to oil producers, but this is still far better than the alternative of shipping by rail. And the effect of that is to shrink the gap between prices received by producers in Canada and the prices that prevail abroad, you know, set by global markets. So effectively, this new piece of infrastructure raises prices of a key export commodity for Canada, and that boosts GDP with implications for not just the oil and gas sector, but sectors and provinces right across the country, and government revenues, corporate income taxes, federally being an important one as well. Bank of Canada just a couple of weeks ago estimated that this project coming on the scene alone is going to boost second quarter growth by a quarter of a percentage point, which sound like a lot, but times that by 3 trillion and you get a pretty big number. So it's really hard to understate the value of this as a piece of infrastructure. But I think what's potentially most surprising is that it's also still a profitable and valuable asset as a pipeline itself, putting aside all the broader economic implications.
Yeah, I mean, for listeners who may forget, because of the way that Canadian oil is exported, it sells at a lower rate than others, right?
That's right. And that gap, the differential, we call it, between Canadian prices and prices elsewhere varies depending on market conditions. But, you know, a normal gap is going to be something on the order of maybe $15 a barrel, give or take, plus or minus five in either direction. So that's a considerable haircut that effectively producers are receiving in Canada. And sometimes that differential can grow very large, you know, easily exceeding sometimes $40, $50 per barrel. And that gap is largely set, I'm going to oversimplify things, but set by the cost of shipping out the marginal barrel. And so if we move into higher cost export modes like rail, then that differential widens. And so it's infrastructure like this that has benefits for the whole industry, even if you're not shipping your own oil as a producer through the pipeline itself. It kind of lifts the whole sector.
Trevor Tome is with us this half hour, professor of economics at the University of Calgary. We're talking about the opening of the Trans Mountain Pipeline. It is now shipping oil, the twinning of it, essentially, the new part. In many years in the making, many billions over budget, but still it is operational. And Trevor, I think there was always this concern. I mean, not necessarily, because a lot of people who tend to really focus on the taxpayers being left holding the bag issue are kind of the same people who might be benefiting, who are sort of pro oil and gas. So I don't want to simplify too much. Right. But ultimately, when you looked at even with the cost overruns, and you've been talking about it already, taxpayers here won't be left holding the bag necessarily on this one.
Well, there still is some uncertainty. So I don't want to present a false sense of security here, but there's every reason to believe there are many scenarios where taxpayers don't get a loss. And that's certainly what I think is much more likely than not. And before I get into the numbers, I just want to be crystal clear that it would have been better had the pipeline not experienced the cost overruns that
seven
it
times
is. So however valuable it is, it would be even more valuable had it been able to be constructed more efficiently than it was. So I'm not excusing the $34 billion, but here we are. Given that $34 billion, many people look at that and think, well, if we can't sell the pipeline for at least $34 billion, then taxpayers are going to take a hit. And that's the wrong way to think about it. We bought the pipeline, both the old original pipeline and the project itself, for $4.5 billion a few years ago. And then the construction costs were largely paid for with debt. And that's relevant because any future buyer of the pipeline, they wouldn't pay the $34 billion in construction costs. They would pay less, but they would also assume the debt obligations.
Right.
So they would be taking that off of the government's books, if you will. So we need to think about, well, what's the value of the pipeline per year to any potential owner? Well, the high level of debt that paid for the construction costs, that comes with high interest costs, of course, and the need to repay this debt over time. But luckily, the revenues from the pipeline are considerable. Its first year of operations is looking to have revenues on the order of about $3 billion in that first year. And it only costs about $500 million to operate. So there's a lot of surplus there that a big chunk of it, a little over $1.5 billion, about $1.6 billion, will go to interest and some additional amounts to some other, you know, accounting items, but also some debt repayments. But add up depreciation, operating expenses, interest on debt, and soon taxes, because there will be profit on the operations of this pipeline, there's still a good amount left in terms of profit per year. So if you look out 20 years, and of course, things will vary depending on what they're allowed to charge per barrel, and that's still not set firmly yet. We have an interim price of $11 per barrel, but if we look out best information we have right now, it looks like the value of cash that will be generated by the pipeline after interest payments, after expenses, after all of the debt repayments over this time horizon could be between four to maybe as high as nearly $9 billion in today's terms. And that's more, like there's many scenarios there, that's more than the $4.5 billion the taxpayers paid. So we shouldn't have in mind 34, that's the wrong number. We should have in mind the $4.5 billion that we paid.
Right. And it sounds like it might be an attractive investment for any number of potential buyers, right? Because the federal government now fairly quickly wants to offload this whole project or this whole entity.
Yeah, that's certainly their stated goal. And you know, for the most part, even though it's profitable, the government's not in the business of owning things just because they're profitable. We don't nationalize profitable businesses just because they generate profit. We want to have assets in the hands of those who can operate them efficiently and most appropriately from an economic perspective. And that's generally not the government. And so they will be looking for a buyer to maximize the sale price here. And of course, there's going to be a lot of details in terms of who those buyers are, what the terms are. And those details are, you know, of course, right now, definitely not known by anybody. Mm-hmm. But the equity in the project right now, like right now in the financial filings, the current equity is $8 billion. And so that alone is higher than what was paid for it. Now, the details are going to matter. And then a potential buyer is going to need to be thinking about uncertainties decades into the future, what fraction of the capacity of the oil pipeline will be used. And that means you need to think about what the production volumes in Alberta are going to be and so on. And those are important scenarios to think about. But it is absolutely not a foregone conclusion that taxpayers are on the hook. And it's absolutely not the case that any future buyer would need to pay $34 billion in order to make us whole, because taxpayers never actually paid for all of those, most of the construction cost. It was debt. And that debt is going to be assumed by any future buyer in all likelihood.
Right. You also pointed out something else that was interesting, that building it now is always cheaper than building it later. And clearly the pipeline, I mean, this people will debate this, but clearly Canada needed another pipeline to the West Coast from Alberta. And now we have it. It's built. It's not quite paid for, but at least we know what it cost. Because building another one in 15, 20 years, I mean, the number that you came up, I think, was astronomical, is just going to get more and more expensive.
So it's certainly the case that building it now is more valuable than doing it later. There's uncertainty in the future, of course, around what the pipeline capacity is that we'll need. And that's all about future oil production volumes. And that depends on policy choices that Canadian governments make in the future, but also global developments that are really hard to foresee. So having the asset now, when there is a need, maximizes the value of this infrastructure, because we know that at least in the short and medium term, it's going to be incredibly valuable economically. So the longer we wait to have something like this, the longer we incur that higher than necessary gap between the price of what we're exporting that we receive and the world price. And when you look at it broadly from the economy's perspective, you know, those gains are considerable. Just for perspective here, the Canada Energy Regulator does these estimates. Its most recent one is a few years old, so these numbers might change if they were to update it. But they looked all the way out to 2040. And thought about, you know, what would it look like if we had no new pipelines? And that would be a reduction in the overall amount of economic activity in today's terms of Canada's economy of about $240 billion.
Wow. And
that's the number that you want to have in mind when you're comparing it to the cost of the pipeline. So that the payoff period, if you will, for this pipeline from a broad economic perspective is just a few years. And so that's not a bad return. And so each year that you wait, you're incurring significant economic costs.
Well, Trevor, I appreciate your time as always. Thank you.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
first national election since January 6th, insurrection placed a dagger at the throat of American democracy since that moment. We all know who Donald Trump is. The question we have to answer is, who are we? That's what's at stake.
That was, of course, U.S. President Joe Biden on the third anniversary of the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol. So several months ago now, but clearly this has been one of the ballot box issues in the upcoming presidential election for the Democrats, is that former President Trump was, is, and remains a threat to U.S. democracy. Now, Trump calls that fear-mongering, still maintains the 2020 election was stolen, despite absolutely no evidence at all to prove that. But the polls suggest, no matter what, that the rematch of the 2020 election coming up in just a little more than 6 months, pitting once again now President Joe Biden versus then President Donald Trump, or former President Donald Trump, will be a very close one. That either candidate still stands a good chance, perhaps, of winning. Both can have some confidence at this point in time. If anything, I was watching, seeing some polls today that show that Donald Trump is ahead in many of the swing states. I mean, don't forget, in an American election these days, it really boils down to about seven states and how they vote. I mean, most of the other ones are sort of accounted for. So it all boils down to these swing states like Michigan and Pennsylvania and Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, and so on. You'll remember from watching these the last time around. But what exactly would a second Trump presidency look like? Well, as is often the case, he's only too eager to kind of share that. Now, if you watch his rallies or you see him do regular interviews, you don't really get much, right? I mean, there's a lot of bluster, and whatever he's up to or onto that day, that's what he'll talk about. But my next guest, he got a lot of that detail. He spoke twice to the former president over the last month and a bit. Once, a lengthy sit-down interview at Mar-a-Lago, and then he had it over the phone to try and, you know, circle back on some of the issues that he had touched on. And it was a wide-ranging series of interviews talking about everything from immigration and abortion, of course, which has become a huge deal, a huge issue in the U.S., still is, since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, to trade, which impacts Canadians, obviously, and even the justice system and how he would operate there, because there has always been this belief that part of his desire to get back into the White House has to do with his own criminal issues, his own trials that are going on, and also as retribution, because he has a long list of people that he doesn't like. And the fear is that he'll exact revenge if and when he gets back into power. The journalist also spoke with several of those closest to the Republican nominee Trump, and what emerged were the outlines of what you could call an imperial, as he puts it, an imperial presidency that would reshape America and its role in the world. His supporters, Trump supporters, may say that is for the better. His critics obviously see that, and allies too, may see that as far, far worse. Eric Cortaleza is the national political reporter with Time. He is the one who sat down with former President Trump in person and then on the phone, and it all culminated in this very impactful, much read, and much scrutinized article in Time called How Far Trump Would Go. And Eric joins me now from Washington. Eric, thanks for your time tonight.
Well, thank you for having me.
Journalist to journalist, what an amazing opportunity to be able to sit down with the former president twice. And actually, really, one thing that struck me just by reading the transcript is that you put some really tough questions to him. He doesn't always answer them, but he was prepared to take them.
You know, he was. I mean, give credit to Donald Trump. He was willing to sit down with me for more than an hour at Mar-a-Lago to do a follow-up conversation on the phone 2 weeks later and subject himself to my scrutiny. And I asked him what I thought were rigorous probing questions that were pretty narrowly focused on what he would do if he returned to power. And, you know, his answers speak for themselves.
Indeed. I mean, I guess that was really the crux of this, was to try to figure out what a second Trump term would actually look like in practice. I was curious, you sort of start off the article this way, about what he thought were the issues with his first term. And one of them was that he thought he had been too nice. And that was an interesting answer.
You know, that came in the context of my asking him about the dozens of former cabinet officials,
right,
who served in his first term who refused to endorse him in 2024. And that was a sensitive subject for President Trump. You know, immediately he went into counterpunch mode and denigrated many of the former cabinet officials and secretaries who served with him the last time. And then when I said, well, President Trump, Biden doesn't have any cabinet members who have come out against him, his answer was, well, Biden is a different kind of guy. He keeps bad people. So, you know, President Trump is thinking very deeply and systematically about personnel in a second term. He does not want to have the same hindrances in place that he feels held him back in the second term and in the first term. And one of those things was people he put in positions of power and influence throughout the government. And as he says to me, I'm not going to be so nice this time. If people who I hire, and that's his words, he hires for these government appointments or other positions in the White House aren't committed to fulfilling my vision, they're out of here.
Yeah, I mean, that was what really stood out about the entire interview and the article itself was this idea. I mean, a lot of the chaos surrounding Donald Trump in his first term, I think, stood in the way of some of the things he wanted to get done. You get the impression that if a second term were to come, he hits the ground running in a very different way. And that really jumped out from your interview.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of things happening at once. Donald Trump himself is sort of razor focused, if you will, on returning to the Oval Office and being able to exact retribution, in his own words, in a host of different ways. One of them is simply having the ability to be president and implement executive authority once again. He is surrounding himself with advisors and aides and experienced government bureaucrats who are devising up plans, the mechanics of how to implement his ideas, put them into action when he takes office. And all of that is going to be having done in conjunction with Trump having engineered a much more compliant Congress, right? He is intervening in primary races for House and Senate seats throughout the country to make sure that Republicans in the House and Senate are aligned with him so they can approve his legislation and, critically, in the Senate, his cabinet nominees.
When you've described it, it happens a few times in the article, as sort of an imperial presidency, right? I mean, the amount of power the president would have, the checks and balances that are now in place to try to hold back a president from doing as they please, those have always been things that Donald Trump has railed against. And I got the sense from the way he speaks to you now that he feels absolutely no differently about that, that he really sees, sort of to use the French, l'état c'est moi, the state is me.
He does feel that way. I mean, he feels that if he wins, then the voters have sent a mandate for him to govern on what he campaigned on. And, you know, one of the ways in which he wants to restore the imperial presidency is to diminish the powers of career government bureaucrats who are not politically appointed. He doesn't feel like unelected bureaucrats, if you will, in agencies, government agencies should have the ability to thwart the stated policy of the president. He wants to restore the power of impoundment, which would allow him to withhold congressionally appropriated funds. That was a favorite maneuver of Richard Nixon's. He used it to hold funding that was going to go to the EPA, that's the Environmental Protection Agency, that was going to go to affordable housing. It was made illegal in 1974 through the Impoundment Control Act. And Trump and his advisors are planning to challenge that law in court or try and pass a new law that would overturn the Impoundment Control Act. And those are just, you know, a few examples of the ways in which he wants to consolidate power around the office of the presidency.
You touched on, throughout this interview, or these two interviews, you touch on many different topics that I think are of great interest. Certainly the border, immigration, migration was one of the top ones. And you do paint, I mean, and he has no problem sort of admitting to all of this, you do paint a pretty difficult looking picture for what a first day under a second President Trump term would look like for those who find themselves in his crosshairs, illegal migrants, essentially.
It's certainly a cornerstone of the president's campaign. Immigration and the border has been a Trumpian obsession since the dawn of his political rise. If he were to win, you should expect some very aggressive actions on the border and through immigration immediately. I mean, he's going to restore everything that he had in the first term, remain in Mexico, Title 42. There'll be a different justification for that emergency measure. He'll probably cite either just high levels of illegal crossings, fentanyl or child trafficking or things of that sort. And he is going to embark, as he tells me, on a massive deportation operation that would include hauling away more than 11 million people in this country who are without citizenship. And so that means that he's planning to use the National Guard, as he tells me, to go inland throughout the country to find and remove undocumented migrants. He will try to incentivize local and state police departments to participate by tying funding initiatives to their involvement. And most strikingly, he said he would be willing to use the military if he felt that was necessary. In America,
which you point out is illegal, right? Is illegal. I mean, at least unconstitutional.
Well, I point that out to President Trump. I mean, I say, sir, the Posse Comitatus Act says that you cannot use the military on civilians. And, you know, his answer to me was, they're not civilians. He does not consider undocumented migrants to be civilians. That's not how the law interprets it, of course. But, you know, President Trump sees them as invaders who are in our country illegally and has no compunction about deploying the military to ensure their removal.
Eric Cortellesa is with us this half hour. He's the national political reporter at Time. He sat down with Donald Trump and then did another follow-up interview with the former president by phone. It's the result of that is a very extensive and very interesting article called How Far Would Trump Go? And it looks very concretely into what a second Trump presidency would look like. Eric, on trade, clearly lots of people, you know, I think people in different parts of the world will be picking parts of your article apart to see how it applies to them. A lot of it's domestic and American for obvious reasons. But on for allies, for instance, such as Canada, an issue like trade, this idea of building a ring around America, 10% import tax, I mean, that would be devastating in many ways to major trading partners, especially Canada and Mexico.
You know, for sure. And I should say, Trump said it could be more than 10%, right? So we don't actually know what that baseline tariff on all imported goods is going to be. He's going to be the most aggressive on China and other countries that he feels have been ripping the United States off or where we've been on the other or the wrong side of the trade deficit. You know, this has always been a Trumpian fixation. He feels like the United States gets ripped off on trade and he sees a very transactional sort of sees it through a transactional prism, if you will, trade. And that does mark a contrast to a sort of burgeoning movement here in the United States, particularly on the left, that through trade and through interlinking the economies of Western democracies, we are able to build maximum power and leverage against the rise of authoritarianism. And so Donald Trump doesn't see it through that lens. Donald Trump sees it as the businessman that he is, as a deal maker, and he feels like we're on the wrong end of a deal.
Right. And the same applies to national security as well. I mean, you really dove into that. You talked about Israel, obviously, and NATO and Ukraine. But he still sees this very much as transactional. So for countries such as Canada, whose military spending is not at the NATO 2%, I mean, this could bode not well for countries that he sees, that he believes aren't pulling their weight.
Yeah, and he was very explicit with me on this. I mean, Donald Trump, when I said, Mr. President, you know, would you not defend a NATO ally if they were attacked by Russia or some other adversary and you felt they weren't paying enough for their defense? And his answer was, I said that with great meaning when he said that, you know, Putin can do whatever the hell that we said Russia can do, quote, whatever the hell they want to a NATO country that wasn't spending enough on its defense. And he said that wasn't idle bluster, that, you know, if you don't pay up, you're on your own. And, you know, that marks a very, you might say, stark contrast to previous people who have held the office of the presidency and who see these mutual arrangements, right, these collective security arrangements as vital to our defense policy.
You did put it to him, I think, one of the comments that he made, I think it was to Sean Hannity, that stood out the most is his sort of, I will only be a dictator on my first day. Because, of course, there are a lot of concerns about his view of the presidency as somehow being almost, you know, a coronation, as almost being, you know, a king with no limits. And you asked him about that quote about wanting to being a dictator just on the first day. And his answer to you, and you saved it for the end of the article, so I imagine it was a revealing one, was interesting because, he sees no problem with how he sees his potential to kind of run the show without any challenge.
Right. So, I brought this up. I mean, he said it during an appearance on Sean Hannity. It was a town hall where Sean Hannity lobbed a question that was basically designed to allay concerns that he would abuse power in office or seek dictatorial control. And Donald Trump's answer was, I don't want to be a dictator except for on day one, because he said he was going to close the border. And in his words, drill, baby, drill. And, you know, when I asked him what he meant by that, he said that was a joke. I said that sarcastically in jest. Everybody in the room was laughing. And by the way, this reveals quite a bit about Trump's relationship to his supporters and his own public onstage persona. This is someone who sort of assumes the role of almost stand-up comedian. He has a kind of vaudevillian presence when he's in front of his supporters. He entertains them. He speaks to them. And he claims also to speak for them. Many of these people do think he speaks for them. When I said, well, Mr. President, whether you were joking or not, do you think that such talk of dictatorship runs? Do you see why so many Americans see that talk of dictatorship runs contrary to our most cherished democratic principles? He told me no. He insisted otherwise. His exact words were, I think a lot of people like it.
Right. If he loses, I mean, you broached that to some extent. If he loses, he wouldn't rule out, you know, I mean, he's often talked about the threat of violence. He still won't admit that he lost the 2020 election. What's your sense of what will happen in 2024 if he fails to beat Joe Biden once again?
Well, you know, I can't predict the future as much as I'd like to be able to. All I can say is that, you know, I posed the question to Donald Trump whether he was worried about political violence in connection with the 2024 election in the first interview, and he told me, no, I think we're going to win and there won't be violence.
Right.
Second time I got to speak with him, I followed up on that and I said, well, what if you don't win, sir? And his answer was, he thinks they're going to win. He thinks he's going to win. But then he said, if we don't win, you know, it depends. It always depends on the fairness of an election.
Right.
That comment raised alarms for a lot of people because Donald Trump ostensibly raised the specter of potential political violence.
Just for you, I mean, what did you walk away with from this? I mean, here's someone who many people watch. He's the focus of almost immeasurable media attention through the court cases now and so on. And yet you actually got to sit down with him at this point in history in 2024 and put real questions to him. I mean, he did a lot of Trumpian things, three-year questions, but it felt like he really got an opportunity to press him on things, to ask follow-ups, to get clarification. What did you walk away with this from in terms of what you expected going in and what you got coming out?
Yeah, well, I would say my story is the ultimate answer to that question. And people should go and read it. We also put out the full transcripts for everyone to read. And we included a fact check of the transcripts as well. My major takeaway is that Donald Trump is ever more assertive and confident and ready to return to the White House with a very dogged sense of determination to carry out his will. President Trump is a really smart guy. I think he's still underestimated by many in the mainstream media and throughout the political class. He continues to be underestimated. And Donald Trump right now is embarking on a very strategic and coordinated plan for when, and if and when he becomes president, what he would do. And this was an opportunity to hear in his own words what would happen if he was given a second term. And that's what we set out to do. And that's ultimately what the story illustrates.
Well, if anything, he's at least been upfront about it. I mean, there's that, right? He's been upfront about whether you like it or not, this is his plan. So if and when it happens, people won't be surprised, even though I think a lot of people, it makes people uncomfortable because it is an uncomfortable read in many ways. But that being said, I guess it's all up to voters in November, right?
It's ultimately up to voters. You know, we live in a country of majority rule, so we will find out in November where the voters are. But our hope and our mission was to present in a fair and comprehensive, straightforward way what Trump would do in a second term in his own words.
Eric, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you. Good to talk to you.
I love reading, obviously. I do a lot of reading for this job, and it's always fun to, I read a lot of nonfiction, obviously, because you do, but it's always fun to dig into some good fiction. And here is someone who has really been this book was hotly, widely anticipated. He was voted Greta's best, one of the best young authors in Britain about a decade ago, and has really lived up to that promise. But imagine not really reading a novel until you were 18 or 19, and then going on to become not just a novelist, but a Booker Prize long-listed one twice, and a finalist for the American Library Association's Carnegie Medal, amongst others. Well, that is exactly the path that British novelist Sanjeev Sahota has followed, charting a successful career in fiction after reading Salman Rushdie's Midnight People on a trip to India while he was a teenager more than 20 years ago. His first three novels include Ours Are the Street from 2011, Year of the Runaways, which was awarded the European Union Prize for Literature, and more recently in 2021, The China Room. Sahota's fourth novel is called The Spoiled Heart. It is the first one that he set entirely in his native England. In fact, it is mainly takes place in his hometown of Chesterfield, Derbyshire, in the north of the country. And it is the story of ambition, love, family secrets, and the devastating cascade a small, unthinking act can unleash. And it all centers around a vicious leadership contest between two Brits of Indian descent, who are both trade unionists fighting for the general secretary of this trade union, one of the biggest in England. And they are divided by age, sex, and class. And it turns into a real debate about the idea of class politics and class versus identity politics and identity. Sanjeev Sahota, his latest book is called The Spoiled Heart. And he joins me now from England. Thank you so much for your time tonight.
Thanks, Ben. It's great to be talking to you.
I mean, it's not unique. I mean, I've read lots of books that have been set in Britain, and I realized reading it how rare it is for them to be set in what we could call these days sort of the deindustrialized North. In this case, your hometown of Chesterfield, a town that I get the impression you mightn't have thought you'd ever write about.
This is true, yeah. So this is my fourth novel, and it's my first one that's set completely in the UK. It doesn't kind of go back to India for any kind of historical ballast. And it's certainly the first time I've set a story in Chesterfield, which is a town in the north of England where I grew up. It's a former mining town. It's very deindustrialized. I remember growing up, kind of a sense of betrayal kind of hung in the air. And it's only recently, actually, since my parents retired and left the area, and now I've got no longer have any reason to go back there, that I felt, I guess, that distance gave me an ability to write about it. Suddenly, when something's no longer there for you in the same way, you kind of a renewed affection kind of kicks in.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I first started out in journalism, I was a regional reporter, as most are, in the late 90s. And I went to a lot of towns that were not, they were sort of in Quebec, but these are towns that had, you know, one factory that closed, and we sort of saw the end. And it's interesting about when the novel begins, I guess sort of in the late 90s, that was kind of the end. We sort of saw that shift from the impacts of what had happened in the 80s, specifically in Britain under Margaret Thatcher, but then into sort of the new Labour era. But the promise didn't come back, or at least it didn't feel like it came back. And that sort of stood out to me in your book.
No, you're right. So Thatcher did her work, did her Tory work, and kind of decimated the town and left lots of structural unemployment. And then with New Labour, I guess perhaps some people felt that was going to be a time of regeneration, but I think it felt quite clear quite early on that he wasn't at all interested in questions of kind of equality and bringing back any kind of industrial heartland or even any kind of like sense of vision back to these areas. And even now, we've got a similar conversation happening again now, where the current Conservative government is promising kind of what they're calling levelling up, like we're going to level up the north with the rest of kind of like the UK. And again, it's just empty, meaningless promises that is going nowhere. There's no levelling up. And the north kind of is slightly, yeah, there's an odd north-south divide, which I'm sure is probably there in lots of countries in lots of different ways, whether it's north, south or east-west. But it is quite marked in the UK when the industrial heartlands were kind of just ripped apart.
And it's an interesting, given you grew up in it, it's an interesting setting for this novel. And the whole concept of a battle for the head of a union in of itself is interesting, because it also speaks of a different time to some extent. I mean, you know, unions still have power in Britain and in Canada, but certainly far fewer people belong to unions. What made you decide that would be the setting, sort of that would be the main kind of narrative arc, is this battle for this union presidency?
Yeah, so I've always been, or you know, I've been in the union for many years and I've always been part of kind of one kind of lefty movement or another. I guess growing up in a very working class area, as a very, you know, as in a kind of a working class environment and being working, growing up working class, kind of questions of class and class position and class privilege have always been very clear to me. But also growing up, as I was going to university in London and then into my 20s, it became clear that we don't really talk about class as class. We tend to talk about it as if it is kind of a cultural identity, which is partly because we talk a lot about, and rightly, you know, about race and gender and sexuality and these kind of cultural identities. But we don't really talk about class, which is an economic system. And there was something in there for me as someone who kind of has perhaps has a foot in both camps, both in the race and class, but how these two ideas kind of clash and why we don't talk about class. And when we're talking about race, should we also be talking about class?
And a lot of what you've done, the narrator, of course, feels a bit like you, because it's someone who I think has grown up in Chesterfield and then goes back to sort of tell this story. But the central characters are two characters who very much kind of embody this idea that you're trying to search between the idea of class as being something important, basically of money in many extent, opportunity versus identity. Yeah. And you have these two characters fighting it out for this presidency, and each of them, both of them South Asian of descent, come at it from very different points of view. The main character, Nayan, being the older one who sort of embodies this idea of a union guy, essentially.
Yeah, right. So there's two people running for the general secretary of the union. There's Nayan, who's probably the main protagonist, I'd say. And then there's his rival, Mega, kind of a younger person, new to the union, but very keen to make her mark. And Mega very much believes in kind of a politics of the left that is focused around anti-discrimination. She thinks that the left should be fighting first and foremost against any form of discrimination, that no one should be discriminated against. And that's the biggest thing that holds people back from, and especially holds non-white people back, and women and anyone else, you know, of any marginalized identity from progressing through the world. And Nayan, it's not that Nayan disagrees with anti-discrimination. He doesn't. He actually, I think, does believe that no one should be discriminated against for whatever aspect of their identity. But where Nayan does disagree with Mega is that he doesn't think that anti-discrimination should be kind of like the pole star, the central plank of any left politics. He thinks economic justice and economic equality should be the central kind of fulcrum of any left-wing posture and attitude, because he thinks that if you make that all anti-discrimination asks is that no one should be discriminated against from becoming rich, that all anti-discrimination asks is that people should be allowed to escape poverty. It doesn't actually get rid of the poverty itself. I think that's Nayan's position, and I think it's a position that I have a great deal of sympathy with.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, I've seen you interviewed. I think you did an interview with The Guardian back in 2021 where you raised many of these very same issues. Given where you grew up, given your background, this idea that somehow we no longer talked about class. I mean, class is a difficult one because it all depends, you know, Canada often likes to think of itself as a bit classless compared to the UK, a bit more on the American side. And yes, it all very much exists. In that vein, then, how would you describe, when you say we don't talk about class, how would you describe class in that context?
Well, my view that class is a system of, class is inscribed into kind of like our economic structure, and it's a system of exploitation. And our working class people and poor people are every day kind of exploited for against profit, if we're being quite old school about it. Right. I think we do talk about class, but we talk about class by thematizing it as a cultural identity. We don't talk about class as an actual social economic.
Like Coronation Street, sort of, right? That kind of
Or when we think of class as being, as I say, like as an identity like race or like gender, like sexuality. So when we try to address the problems of class, we use the tools of culture to try to do it. So we talk about class representation, that we need to get some poor people into the corporations, or we talk about respect and anti-discrimination, that working class people should not be discriminated against. And yes, working class people should not be discriminated against, but that is not kind of like the central reason for their victimization. It's exploitation, not discrimination. That's why class is not cultural identity, because the central reason why working class and poor people are victimized is not discrimination, it's exploitation.
Right. And then the other character in this, Megha Sharma, is very much of the other, of the modern sort of way this discourse has. In other words, you're kind of having an argument with yourself in this book about these two discourses, these two different ways of viewing things.
Yeah, there's an opposition. There's an oppositional kind of stance that the book takes in respect to these two ways of looking at social justice. And are you someone whose primary conception of social justice is through identity and discrimination, or is someone whose prime exception of social justice is through economics and the class structure? And the book, I mean, I've always been quite clear on where I stand on that issue. And as I've already said, I'm kind of more in Nyan's camp. But the book is kind of, yeah, part of the whole trade union battle is for these arguments to be made in their fullest way. And I think Megha, I think I've said before that Megha was the hardest character I've ever had to write, because she's probably the only significant non-working class character I've ever written. So trying to get inside of her mindset and give her arguments kind of like the most sympathetic and the fullest airing was actually really difficult, because I think I disagreed with a lot of what she was saying as I was making her say it.
Sanjeev Sahota is with us tonight for this half hour. His new book is called The Spoiled Heart. It's his fourth novel. Two of the previous ones have been on the Booker long lists in the past. So lots of expectation for this one. It's been talked about an awful lot. So Sanjeev, when reading through this book, one of the things that really interested me, also having been in Britain as a correspondent in the early days of Brexit, was just how all these things have then played out. Like, identities become such a primordial thing now in British politics, much more so than class in many ways. And it was interesting to sort of read through that a little bit in the book itself and see things that were about to happen. Obviously, you're writing this with the benefit of hindsight. For audiences outside of Britain, what would you like them to walk away from with these characters and this story, thinking about, I mean, identity politics is something that exists or is being talked about in many places right now.
Yeah, it's always hard to think that, you know, what message I want to leave readers with. Hopefully it's just trying to clarify the questions, or trying to formulate the questions and hopefully in a better and more accurate way in which they've perhaps been constructed in the past. So, yeah, so if we are talking about what do we mean by social justice, what do we mean by a fair society? What is a fair society? Is a fair society where everyone at every income level, or, you know, every group at every income level is unimpeachably diverse? Mm-hmm. But the actual level of poverty doesn't actually change. It just means the rich, the 1% are just, you know, all in their correct proportions, and the poorest are also all in the correct level of diversity, but the actual poverty, economic disparity doesn't change. Is that, I suppose in some sense, that's a fair, it's fairer society than what we've got now in the way that it's to be neoliberally diverse is perhaps better to be than to be neoliberally non-diverse, I guess. But it feels like a pretty low bar for the left to set itself.
Yeah. When you look at sort of things like Brexit, how Brexit was sold, especially in the North and places such as Chesterfield, for instance, what do you make then of the rise of populism and how this all has fit into it in some ways? Because it feels like we've entered, if it used to be a class war, it feels like now we've entered something of an identity war. And I think part of the book is grapples with the many nuances of that.
Yeah, I think this goes back to something we touched on earlier, how class is thematized as if it is an identity. So one of the things we talk about now is the white working class. So right. Class in itself has been raced in that way. So we don't talk about the brown working class or the black working class, because to be brown or to be black is to already have your cultural identity. The point is now to give the working class a cultural identity, which is a racial one. I think the problem when you do that is that when people start, and it creates a politics where people just start being further and further entrenched into their identity and using their identity as their political vehicle. And I mean, the thing about Brexit was that, you know, we had lots of, about how vast swathes of the North voted for Brexit, and they did. And what I found kind of problematic about the discourse around that was that lots of those people were told that, you know, the left isn't, the right is doing what the right does, and the right will other people and use race and culture as a way to sort of divide. That's what the right has always done, and the right will no doubt continue doing that. I'm bothered about what the left does. And what I found problematic in the way the left spoke about Brexit is that it didn't actually say to these people that voted for Brexit or vote for kind of right-wing policies that actually what's messing you over, I was going to use a stronger word, but what's messing you over is you know, is actually nothing to do with race. What's messing you up is to do with the economic structure and the poverty that's, you know, and the people that are causing this poverty aren't your fellow poor non-white people. It's actually the rich. Actually, that's where the problem kind of lies. So the left doesn't tell white working class people that. What the left tells white working class people is that your problem is, you know, that you voted for Brexit because in some sense you're racist and you just need to change your racism. It doesn't actually give them any way to actually formulate their grievances by looking at the economic structure in which they're living in. And actually, if the left did start doing that, I think lots more, hopefully, cross-cultural solidarity could actually be built rather than identity being used as a way to actually just divide. And it's disappointing when the left seems to be doing that in the same way that the right does sometimes.
I mean, I should point out that it is actually just a really good read. That's why people will like it, because it tells a story. The characters are strong. I've read about the books that you've pointed back to, whether it's Salman Rushdie or Mystery or others in the past. I mean, part of this was to tell a really interesting story about interesting characters.
I hope so, yeah. I mean, I hope it's lively. I hope the characters feel true, and I really hope the reader cares what happens.
I suspect they might. Sanjeev, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Ben.